10. The White Revolution and Its Opponents, 1953-1963. The gradual return to autocratic practices after 1953 put an undue end to Iran's perilous experiment with participatory politics. Instead, an era of stability, albeit politically repressive, began to set in, and with the exception of a brief interlude in the early 1960s, it remained essentially unchanged until the Islamic Revolution in 1979 and the collapse of the Pahlavi order. The period between 1953 and 1979 was an era of relative prosperity for the urban middle classes of both the secular and the bazaar sectors, even though economic improvement over the long term did not always translate into political capital for the regime. The quality of life of the rural population, which in the early 1960s still accounted for more than 65% of Iran's total population, also improved, especially with the implementation of land reform, Eslahat-e-Arzi, better education and better healthcare, although, as elsewhere in the developing world, changes in the countryside did not reduce migration to cities and only marginally improved agricultural output. It also caused discontent among rural migrants, both the first and the second generations, who resented the privileged classes and began to take solace in the message of the radicalized clergy, who often came from a similar background. The second Pahlavi era was marked by royal politics of self-aggrandizement, especially in the 1970s, and this image was enhanced by the growth of oil revenue, the rise of a subservient technocrat class, and the unprecedented expansion of security forces and the secret police apparatus. Iran's visibility as a regional power, friendly to the United States and the Western world, and episodes of choreographed populism also contributed. Mohammad Reza Shah's White Revolution of the early 1960s in reality came to fruition in the mid-1970s with greater industrial growth, infrastructure development, institution building, implementation of a planned economy, greater professional expertise, and educational and legal advances for women. These crucial transformations also triggered contesting visions of modernity. The Shah's image of progress, patterned on a westernizing model similar to his father's, was questioned by a small but influential circle of secular dissidents and intellectuals, many with roots in the Tudeh and the national movement of the post-war era. They began to question wholesale subservience to the West and the regime's positivistic ideas of progress. With the uprising of June 1963, a turning point in Iran's shift to Islamic activism, this layman's critique of repression, nepotism, and the perceived moral decline of society increasingly took on an Islamic veneer. Not only young radical clergy, but also revolutionary Marxists and Islamic guerrilla organizations critical of the predominant Westernism began calling for resistance to the Pahlavi regime and eventually to its violent overthrow. Islamic militants, mostly under the aegis of Ayatollah Khomeini, were the ultimate beneficiaries of anti-Pahlavi discourse. They succeeded in incorporating the semantics of the nationalists, the anti-Westernists, and the radical Marxists into their own rhetoric of pristine Islam. Iran as a U.S. ally. The rise of the Shah after 1953 as Iran's new political master was gradual but predictable, given the nearly unanimous support of the Iranian armed forces and the blessing of the United States. In a matter of months, the government formed under General Zahedi, the key agent of the coup that overtook Mossadegh and returned the Shah to power, silenced nearly all forces of dissent. Under the American aegis, a new agreement was also reached on the oil question. On paper, Iran's nationalization of its oil industry was recognized, and in 1954, the National Iranian Oil Company, NIOC, which had been formed under Mossadegh, became the partner in a 50-50 profit-sharing agreement with a new holding company, Iranian Oil Participants Limited, IOP, which consisted of 8 major American, British, and European oil companies. These partners replaced the Anglo-Iranian oil company's monopoly. The pattern roughly resembled the Aramco consortium of Saudi Arabia, with a similar sharing arrangement. Although the new agreement was a far cry from the objectives of the nationalization movement and was unpopular with the general public, It was a face-saving measure for the Shah and for the United States. Known as the Seven Sisters, these oil companies held 60% of the newly formed consortium. They were Standard Oil of California, later Chevron, Standard Oil of New Jersey, later Exxon, Standard Oil of New York, later Mobil, Texaco, later Chevron, and Gulf Oil, later Chevron, each holding an 8% stake, Royal Dutch Shell with 14%, and Compagnie Française des Pétroles, later Total, with 6%. Taking over from AIOC, the newly renamed British Petroleum, BP, held the remaining 40% of the consortium's shares. The consortium was responsible for the exploration, production, and international distribution of Iranian oil, and controlled production levels and the pricing structure. Admittedly operating within a smaller area under concession in Khuzestan than had the former AIOC monopoly, Iran nevertheless remained on the receiving end of the production process, with the National Iranian Oil Company in charge of domestic distribution and overall supervision of the operation, a position that proved mostly a formality, at least in the earlier years. IOP held full control over all operations, did not open books to outsiders, did not allow any AIOC representation on its board, and kept a low political profile while maximizing profits. This was a victory for the big oil companies in tightening their monopoly not only over Iranian oil, but also over more than 80% of world oil production. The amended 25-year concession granted in 1954 to IOP was a further departure from the objectives of the national movement, at least until the early 1973, when the Shah managed to negotiate better terms for production and pricing, and eventually in 1975 declared another nationalization of the oil industry, the third such announcement since 1933, IOP reigned supreme. With the Americans holding the upper hand, the issue was not so much the AIOC's colonial culture, which was gradually disappearing, but a new corporate mentality that allowed the oil companies to manipulate prices and production levels for the Middle East oil market, which, in addition to Iranian oil, included Saudi and Iraqi supply, and soon after those of Kuwaiti and other Persian Gulf producers. Oil production came to occupy an increasingly vital place in the Iranian economy, in turn empowering the state. Whereas in 1950, the height of AIOC's operation, annual Iranian oil production stood at 221 million barrels. By 1969, it had reached 1.064 billion barrels, a nearly five-fold increase. In 1950, Iran's direct revenue from oil production was slightly more than $45 million. But in 1969, in less than two decades, it increased by more than 20 times to $905 million. Allowing for an average rate of inflation of 2.5% in the period between 1959 and 1969, the overall revenue of the state, in absolute terms, was no less than 18-fold. In terms of contribution to the country's total revenue, there was also a significant increase. Whereas between 1949 and 1956, oil income constituted 37% of Iran's revenue, by 1965 it had risen to 67%, steadily increasing thereafter until 1980. As oil consumption grew worldwide, Iranian oil revenue steadily increased throughout the 1970s, in part because of the Shah's success in persuading the reluctant IOP to increase production levels. Oil revenue thus became a crucial factor in the stability of the Pahlavi state. The massive injection of U.S. financial support in the 1950s and early 1960s, as well as military assistance, training, and advising, further boosted the Pahlavi prestige. Up to the mid-1960s, tens of millions of U.S. dollars, originally promised but never delivered to Mossadegh's cash-strapped government, poured into Iranian coffers as non-obligatory aid, or were funneled through the Point 4 program's health and agricultural development projects, or through the purchase of military hardware, infrastructure development loans for building dams and a power grid, direct investment in Iranian industry, and major construction projects won by American firms. The U.S. government's aid program, in reality, was a fraction of what U.S. oil companies collected from investing in Iranian oil, and a negligible expense compared to the benefit of keeping Iran as a strategic ally in the Cold War. This may well explain the United States' reluctance to enforce stringent measures against rampant corruption in high offices and the army. From the American perspective, Iranian collaboration had to be preserved at any price, so as to eradicate any remnants of the Iranian Tudeh and other real or potential sources of dissent after the Mossadegh era. The United States' greater involvement also coincided with a gradual eclipse of British influence in Iranian affairs, especially after the 1956 Suez debacle and British disengagement east of the Suez. The Shah was yet to display the ambitions that made him in the 1970s a regional leader and an international figure of some weight. Beyond systematic eradication of all levels of the Tudeh, in the months after the coup, a few serious protest movements in the bazaar and in the Tehran University were also crushed. On one occasion, confrontation with the bazaar merchants in October 1953 led not only to mass arrests, but also in effect to the demolition of the Tehran bazaar's historic entry archway, apparently a punitive measure against merchants. On December 8, 1953, in Tehran University, the armed forces opened fire indiscriminately on students who were protesting the visit of U.S. Vice President Richard Nixon, aimed to consolidate U.S.-Iranian ties. Organized by the left, which resented the arrival of the well-known American Cold Warrior, the demonstration saw at least three students killed and many more injured, thus marking the event as the Student Day of protests in the Iranian dissent calendar. Though the Shah tried to commiserate with the victims and even issued his regrets, the giving of an honorary degree to Nixon a few days later on the campus of Tehran University added insult to injury. One of the Shah's close American friends and staunch advocates, Nixon also benefited in later years from the royal largesse during his presidential campaigns. The unrest displayed the unpopularity of the new regime among the bazaar merchants, the intellectuals of the left, and university students. The Shah, quickly taking center stage, was able to convince the Americans to abandon General Zahedi in his own favor. Under Zahedi's watch, much had allegedly been embezzled. The Shah also argued that the Pahlavi regime, without Zahedi at the helm, would enjoy greater legitimacy and popular acceptance from the bazaar and the clergy. Zahedi was ambitious and independent, and frictions with the Shah over control of the army and government affairs were unavoidable. By April 1955, General Zahedi resigned and left the country to serve as Iran's ambassador to Rome, the same city where the Shah had taken refuge less than 2 years earlier. The virtual exile, from which Zahedi never returned, removed a powerful contestant, but also exposed the Shah, in due course, to greater public scrutiny and made him a target of domestic and international criticism. The Anti-Baha'i Campaign. The recurring suppression of sporadic protests in the wake of the 1954 oil agreement, the systematic arrests of Tudeh members, the long sentences handed down in military courts, and several rounds of merciless executions of Tudeh members, all tarnished the Shah's image. The purging of pro-Mossadegh elements was less severe and often conducted on a case-by-case basis, in accordance with the Shah's degree of dislike for one or the other individual. The United States could barely disguise its blessing for these purges, a demeanor that militated against its efforts to buttress the Shah's regime as popular and democratic. To seek rapprochement with the high-ranking clergy in Qom and elsewhere, the Shah capitalized on the common dislike for Mossadegh and a joint desire to eliminate the Tudeh. Despite all the lip service to Islam, the Tudeh remained second only to the Baha'is in posing a doctrinal challenge to clerical establishment. A few months earlier, in the fall of 1954, the impending execution of Mossadegh's foreign minister Hossein Fatemi, who entertained some Islamic sentiments, caused uproar among the clergy. Their earlier petition to commute his death sentence was ignored. By early 1955, the Shah thus was looking for an occasion to mend fences. He was also anxious to secure the clergy's blessing to join the 1955 Baghdad Pact, a defense treaty that included Iran's neighbors Iraq, Turkey, and Pakistan, as well as Britain and the United States, as observer members after Iraq's withdrawal from the treaty in 1958, it became the Central Treaty Organization, or CENTO, a Cold War strategic alliance complementing the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO. The pact was inspired as much by the Eisenhower Doctrine as it was orchestrated by Britain out of anxiety over the Suez Canal and the increasingly anti-British posture of Egypt's President Gamal Abdel Nasser. The Shah's insistence on being included in the pact sprang more from his own insecurities than from persuasion by the observer members. With the growth of pro-Nasser sentiments, even in Iran, support of the clergy seemed essential to the Shah. The Shah's approach to Ayatollah Sayyid Hossein Borojerdi, 1875 to 1961, a senior mujtahid who had emerged in the late 1940s as the sole marja, supreme exemplar, with a wide acceptance in the Shi'i world, would have been a clever move had it not been for its unexpected consequences. Mostly through a network of students, agents, and followers in the bazaar, Borojerdi had created a power base unmatched by any marja, at least since the time of Mirza Hassan Shirazi, some 50 years earlier. Coming from a middle-ranking clerical family in Borojerd, he was a product of Isfahan and Najaf Shi'i training, a student of Najaf's pro-constitutional Muhammad Kazem Khorasani. Borojerdi gained prominence after he moved to Qom in 1945 and helped build it up as a Shi'i clerical center that, if not on par with Najaf, was at least the most important such center inside Iran. He, indeed, was the first marja to emerge inside Iran, and more than earlier marjas in Iraq, he had to adjust to Iran's political realities and build up his standing with his Iranian constituency. The renewal of the ancient fellowship of the good religion and good government, especially after a cooling off under Reza Shah, required the public disowning of a heretical other. Now that Tudeh and Mossadegh were out of the picture, both Borojerdi and the Shah wished to consolidate their grounds by no more viable a target than an anti-Baha'i campaign. The eclipse after 1953 of Ayatollah Abul Qasem Kashani, the controversial clerical leader of the national movement era, and his absence from the public arena, further contributed to Borojerdi's rise and his restoration of the old state-clergy pact. Shrewd, pragmatic, and resolute, Borojerdi was willing to negotiate with the Shah, giving his implicit blessing to the monarch in exchange for a freer hand in quashing presumed threats to Islam and Muslims. Above all, he demanded a thorough purge of the Baha'is at all levels within and outside the government. Among the Shi'i authorities, animosity towards the Baha'is was deep, in part because of doctrinal reasons, but also in the 20th century, because of a paranoid fear of Baha'i infiltration of government and society, and of their presumed success in converting Muslims over to their deviant path. Through intermediaries, Borojerdi demanded that because the clergy, with himself at the helm, supported Tudeh purges, in return the Shah should repay them by eradicating the Baha'i menace. In April 1955, at the outset of Ramadan, a relatively obscure preacher, Muhammad Taghi Falsafi, 1908-1998, whose fiery oratorical style compensated for his checkered past, began an orchestrated anti-Baha'i campaign that lasted through the month of fasting. The lunchtime sermons from the government-controlled Masjid-e-Shah at the entrance to the Tehran Bazaar were broadcast live on government-controlled Radio Iran, an unprecedented favour that denoted the state's endorsement of the campaign. With Borojerdi's personal blessing, Falsafi attacked Baha'i beliefs as heretical and anti-Islamic, and accused them of betrayal of the nation, of conspiracy and moral corruption, and of being a major threat to the preservation of Islamic Iran. He demanded the government not only ban all Baha'i communal events and administrative bodies, but also expropriate all Baha'i communal and personal property, and remove Baha'is from all government posts and private enterprises. And he even went as far as calling for their mass banishment from the country. The Baha'is were the largest religious minority in Iran, and by the mid-1950s they constituted a population of at least 300,000, widely spread throughout the towns and villages of Iran. Falsafi's campaign found resonance among the clergy and their conservative following, resuscitating a sense of unanimity, especially in the aftermath of the Mossadegh era. They were happy to find a sympathetic partner in the Pahlavi Shah. Since as early as the Babi persecutions in the Qajar period, Baha'is had been routinely demonized as enemies of Islam. With the new campaign against them, however, the nature of the accusations shifted to a higher level. They were accused not only of doctrinal enmity to Islam, but also of being politically disloyal to the country. These set the ground, starting in the 1960s, of accusing the Baha'is of being agents of British colonialism, and soon after of being agents of American imperialism and international Zionism, charges that after the 1979 Islamic Revolution had serious repercussions for the Baha'i community in Iran. The anti-Baha'i campaign soon led to discrimination against the Baha'is and acts of violence, especially against smaller urban communities and those in rural areas. In Najafabad, then a small town 180 miles west of Isfahan, known for its conservative Shi'i loyalties, the large Baha'i community was ostracized through an economic boycott. In Ardestan, another old semi-agricultural community, the Baha'i were to be evacuated overnight for fear of a massacre. In Yazd, when some Baha'is were killed by a mob, the members of the Baha'i Assembly, the elected local governing body, were held responsible for alleged crimes and sentenced to long prison terms. A climate of fear and intimidation soon overcame Baha'is everywhere. Advocating the message of the radical preacher and his powerful backer, some deputies in the Majlis, fast becoming pliant to the Shah's wishes, proposed a bill designed to expropriate all Baha'i properties and expel them from Iran. Even though the bill was eventually withdrawn, this did not stop other drastic measures. A crowd of supporters, buoyed by Falsafi's hate campaign, organized a vigilante takeover of the Baha'i center in Tehran. In Shiraz, the mob attacked the house of the Bab, the holiest site for the Baha'i and Azali in Iran, and all but destroyed it. As a sign of the government's solidarity with the anti-Baha'i campaign, but in reality a weak attempt to control the situation, in May 1955, General Nader Batmanglij, chief of staff of the Iranian Armed Forces, dispatched troops to occupy the Baha'i center in Tehran. The general personally climbed to the roof to strike the first symbolic blow, demolishing the center's dome. Under pressure from Western governments and facing international criticism, and from Baha'i communities worldwide, the Shah began to back off, having sensed the looming repercussions of the campaign getting out of hand. By the end of Ramadan, the most egregious persecutions had subsided. Yet the ban on Baha'i communal activities remained in force. They continued to be banned from government employment, at least officially, and the Baha'i Center in Tehran was converted into the headquarters of the Tehran Military Command and Army Counterintelligence, the nucleus of what later became the Organization for Security and Intelligence, or the SAVAK. Yet the plight of the Baha'is could have been far worse. The anti-Baha'i campaign, as it turned out, was not as severe as, for example, the mistreatment of the Jewish community of Turkey during World War II. It was also incomparable to anti-Jewish campaigns in Egypt in 1956 and 1957 in the aftermath of the Suez Crisis, and in Iraq during the war, and more systematically from the 1950s onward. For the Shi'i leadership, the anti-Baha'i campaign nevertheless reasserted Barujerdi's leadership at the expense of Islamic activists and Fadayan-e-Islam. For years to come, the low-intensity anti-Baha'i posture gave to the Shi'i leadership weight and panache. Such fatwas as banning Pepsi-Cola on the grounds that it was bottled in Iran under a concession granted to a Baha'i entrepreneur, Habib Sabet, 1903-1990, was one such example. The anti-Baha'i smear, moreover, facilitated the launch of other initiatives by Barujerdi, including the building of Masjid-e-Azam, the Grand Mosque, next to the shrine of Mahsumeh in Qom, the expansion and further centralization of the Hawzeh, a conglomerate of seminaries in Qom, and the sponsorship of anti-Baha'i publications, such as a new Persian translation of the 13th volume of Muhammad Bagher Majlisi's encyclopedic Bihar el-Anwar. An earlier translation of this volume, which was exclusively devoted to the Shi'i Hadith on the return of the Mahdi and apocalyptic events at the end of times, had stirred much polemical debate among Baha'i preachers because of inconsistencies in the Shi'i narrative. The new translation, commissioned by Barujerdi in the last year of his life and carried out by the Shi'i scholar Ali Davani, 1929-2007, streamlined Bihar's inconsistencies by omitting some reports and rendering others in such a way as to offer a congruent version useful for anti-Baha'i debates. The thrust of Islamic energies during the 1950s and 1960s indeed included anti-Baha'i actions, mostly polemical debates on the issue of prophecies, by such organizations as the Hojatiyeh Society, a network of lay and clerical activists around Sheikh Mahmoud Halabi, 1900-1998. Yet rapprochement between the Shah and the pro-regime clergy did not stop Shi'i radicalism altogether. Consolidation of royal power. By the late 1950s, the rapid expansion of the security and intelligence organization, known by the Persian acronym SAVAK, proved crucial in suppressing all forms of opposition. It also proved a successful tool in intimidating the general public. Rooted in the Tehran military command under the charismatic, though ruthless, General Temur Bakhtiar, the new organization, under the Americans' watch, was designed to uproot communism within the armed forces, government, and society at large, similar to the demands of the United States for most of its authoritarian allies in the developing world. Relying on the law of national security, first initiated by Mossadegh and revived after him, in 1957, SAVAK was mandated to operate under the Prime Minister's office. Temur Bakhtiar, 1914-1970, son of a Bakhtiari tribal chief, was educated in Beirut and Paris, where he attended Saint-Cyr. He quickly rose to prominence under General Zahedi, and as head of the military command, he had a major part in hunting Tudeh activists and other political dissidents. When the last of the Tudeh cells had been cracked, and operatives such as Khosra Ruzbeh, 1915-1958, a radical Marxist-Leninist theoretician and core organizer of a secret communist officer's cell, were captured and executed, SAVAK began to search for other dissidents. Ruzbeh, who for some years before his capture in 1957 had lived a clandestine life marked by armed clashes with security forces, failed to rekindle a meaningful resistance even within his own small circle of sympathizers. After his execution, however, he gained legendary, almost romantic standing as a martyr of the left and a symbol of resistance. His advocacy of armed resistance may well be considered an inspiration for the Marxist urban guerrilla movement of the late 1960s. By the early 1960s, SAVAK, under the Shah's sponsorship, had begun to earn a reputation for efficiency and discipline, but also for fear-mongering and ruthlessness, purposefully cultivating an image even darker than its reality. Among SAVAK's new targets were independent political figures, the younger generation of intellectuals, members of the former National Front, leaders of student demonstrations, and outspoken clergy. When the Shah ousted Temur Bakhtiar in 1961, SAVAK was brought even more tightly under his direct control. Accused of conspiring against the Pahlavi regime in the outset of a new episode of anti-Pahlavi resistance, the general was forced into exile in Geneva, where he began organizing an anti-Pahlavi front together with an exiled Tudeh leader and Ayatollah Khomeini, the emerging de facto leader of the anti-regime clergy in Qom. Bakhtiar consequently fled to Lebanon and then to Iraq, where a SAVAK agent assassinated him in August 1970. The ouster of Bakhtiar was the last significant military hurdle in the Shah's path to absolute power. He was also the first of the top brass to fall victim to the Shah. Throughout the 1960s, the forced retirement of a number of high-ranking generals and the sacking of career officers revealed the Shah's desire for greater control in the style of his father. The dismissed officers were accused of real or propped-up charges of financial misappropriation, ineptitude, and even spying for the Soviet Union. Nearly all the chiefs of staff during the 1960s and early 1970s were dismissed with disgrace, or put on trial and imprisoned, or they were sent into exile. Like the civilian technocrats, the top military soon learned to sing the glories of their imperial master. The Shah's ever-growing thirst for the latest military hardware and his build-up of the armed forces into a mega-machine further cultivated a spirit of blind submission to the wishes of the King of Kings, the Grand Commander of the Armed Forces, Bazorg Arteshtaran, and even the Godhead, Khadaigan, epithets by which the Shah was exalted in the pure Persian adopted by the armed forces. The figurehead of limited means of the 1940s had transformed into a man of great ego with a complex personality and a burgeoning sense of mission. Born in 1919, when his father was still a middle-ranking officer of the Cossack Brigade, Mohammad Reza was brought up in the early Pahlavi era under the watchful eye of a demanding father who had an overpowering personality. He remained closer to his caring mother than to his father, and he bonded with his twin sister, Ashraf Pahlavi, a great influence on him. As the senior son of a growing family, Mohammad Reza was nominated to be crown prince at the age of 6, and he was educated accordingly in the newly established Pahlavi court by a number of private tutors. Later in the 1920s, he briefly attended the Tarbiyat Baha'i School, then a progressive institution in Tehran. In 1931, he was sent off to Switzerland to the elite Le Rosay boarding school, and he returned in 1936, proficient in French and English. He was more interested in sports, especially soccer, than in international affairs or intellectual pursuits. In the Iranian Military Academy, which he attended to fulfill his father's wishes, he reached the rank of lieutenant, shadowing his father in most public events during the final years of his rule. His arranged marriage with Princess Fawzia, 1921-2013, a sister of King Farouk of Egypt, at the age of 20, was more to buttress a political alliance and gain prestige for the Pahlavi court than being his own personal choice. It turned out to be an unhappy union. The shy and mild-mannered young Mohammad Reza, brought up under the stern shadow of his disciplined father, at the age of 22 faced the first test of his political career, when he inherited a shaky throne with questionable legitimacy. Largely ignored by the leaders of the occupying allies during World War II, with the exception of Joseph Stalin, who paid him a visit during the 1943 Tehran Conference, and separated from his family, who remained in exile in Johannesburg until his father's death, the new Shah seemed unprepared for the political turmoil of the post-war era. He was suspicious of elder statesmen and wary of the freer political climate that had emerged virtually overnight. With a barrage of attacks in the press and from the public against his father's misdeeds and crimes, he had little choice but to express his regrets and promise the return of confiscated properties to their original owners, as well as compensation for past abuses. In the court of law, his father was condemned for expropriating villages and estates, more than 5,000 of them, and for accumulating substantial illicit wealth in personal bank accounts. In the face of numerous political challenges to the Pahlavi throne from the Tudeh and other contenders, the young Shah could do little but to nurture the loyalty of the statesmen and army officers who had served his father. At the same time, he was trying to remain a monarch loyal to the constitutional process, a role he soon began to reconsider when faced with enormous political challenges to his office. He was compelled to play a more proactive role. The success of the 1946 Azerbaijan campaign was a turning point. He was recognized not merely as the nominal head of the armed forces, but also as an active participant in the campaign. The Azerbaijan crisis, moreover, was the beginning of long-term reliance on advice and moral support from the United States. An attempt against his life in 1949, from which he miraculously escaped, and soon afterward the arduous course that ended with the coup of 1953, transformed the young Shah from a reactive maneuverer into a shrewd, even devious, manipulator. Especially after the tumultuous Mossadegh years, he learned to dominate the political stage at the expense of any independent voice within or outside his immediate reach. The bitter experience of the Mossadegh years washed away whatever faith he might have had in the democratic process or in what his more liberal-minded advisers urged him to adopt. The experience made him suspicious of popular participation at any level and of genuine debate on any political issue. Although he offered his early support for the oil nationalization campaign, After July 1952, he found himself marginalized and unwanted. From his perspective, Mossadegh's course not only aimed to overthrow him and eliminate the monarchy, but also would bring the country to the brink of chaos and eventually the throes of communism. His flight to Baghdad and then to Rome in August 1953, after the failure of the first coup to oust Mossadegh, and his return under the shadow of a second coup staged with active help from American and British agents, was a tormenting memory, even though he presented it to his people as a patriotic victory over unspecified enemies. In later years, the annual anniversary of the coup of the 28th of Mordad, August the 28th, 1953, was an exercise in hollow slogans bellowed across the radio waves, military music, and flag-waving rallies. Underneath the annual ritual, there was an unsettled royal psyche that wished to convince people of the Shah's troubled legitimacy. The Shah's attitude toward foreign powers was no less problematic. He remained generally suspicious of their intrigues and entertained conspiratorial fantasies, especially toward the British. The forced abdication of his father taught him to remain distrustful of Britain's real or presumed mischief, and his Cold War mentality, darkened by the Tudeh experience, made him, even more than the British, fearful of Russian-backed plots, which also had been a fear of all of his predecessors since the early 19th century. The United States appeared to be a natural ally and a moral refuge for the Shah, a superpower willing to lionize him and ingratiate itself to his wishes. The United States, to the Shah, was the innocent abroad, powerful and well-intentioned, but naive. For all practical purposes, the Shah's ties to the US appeared to be a perfect match, offering him security and support in exchange for America's strategic concerns and energy needs. The American policymakers, with few exceptions, viewed the Shah's authoritarian rule as simply an unpleasant fact of life, about which they could do little, if anything. Such an attitude partially changed in the early 1960s when the Kennedy administration came to office. But once the Shah's white revolution had reached a certain momentum, he managed to persuade the United States and the Western world to view him not only as the only viable choice for Iran, but also as a bulwark against rising anti-American sentiments in the region. Policing the strategically vital Persian Gulf against Egypt and Iraq was a mission he undertook primarily of his own volition. He viewed his regime, at least for the sake of the captivated Western media, as heir to the ancient Persian Empire and a potent alternative to what he conceitedly viewed as the waning of Western democratic institutions. The early 1960s witnessed a major shift in the country's agrarian structure, but also in the rise of literacy, urbanization, and living standards, all with lasting consequences. The series of state-sponsored reforms that came to be known as the White Revolution, Engelab-e Sefid, largely implemented between 1961 and 1965, produced a sizable population surplus in the countryside, which poured from the villages into towns and cities, unleashing a popular force that, though first backing the Pahlavi reforms, eventually shifted away from the state toward other alternatives. Even as early as the 1950s, new cracks were visible on the surface. Corruption and mismanagement within the civilian administration and military took a turn for the worse, especially with the influx of US aid and growing income from oil. Oddly enough, at the same time, the budget deficit, particularly its foreign exchange reserves, grew to such an extent that the government was brought to the brink of bankruptcy. The token show trials and purging of army officers and civil servants on charges of corruption and embezzlement did little to win over a public suspicious of the state's sincerity, the role of the foreign powers, and the Shah's goodwill. The trial of General Mohammad Vali Gharani, the head of the military counterintelligence, who was arrested in 1958 and tried along with his accomplices on the charge of contemplating a military coup with the backing of the US Central Intelligence Agency, was one example. He was convicted and served a prison term, but the Shah's anxiety hardly subsided. He viewed the planned coup as a symptom of the Americans' uncertain loyalties toward him, and, even worse, as providing the potential for American, British, and even Soviet manipulation and mischief within Iranian armed forces. Gharani's case, in effect, was an early sign of American displeasure with Iran's unstable state of affairs. To remedy growing public mistrust and fearing a revival of the opposition forces from the Mossadegh era, the Shah briefly toyed with the idea of a two-party system to allow for a semblance of popular participation. In reality, the two parties, the Meliun Party, the party of the nationalists, and the Mardam Party, the party of the people, were presided over by two of the Shah's most trusted aides, known for their subservience to the royal's wishes. The result was nothing short of a puppet show, cynically staged to enhance the Shah's public image at home and abroad. By the time the election of the 20th Majlis was underway in August 1960, there was enough fraud and vote rigging that even the Shah could no longer put his seal of approval on the sitting premier Manoucher Ekbal, the leader of the Meliun Party. Ekbal, 1909 to 1977, a French-educated medical doctor and former health minister in Ahmad Gavam's Democrat Party, had served as premier since 1957. An early example of the kind of technocrat who later manned the Pahlavi administration, Ekbal was a capable manager with a facade of sincerity, but he was nevertheless fully obedient to the wishes of his master, even after his removal from office. Yet neither forcing Ekbal to resign nor annulling the election results in the fall of 1960 could persuade the Iranian public of the Shah's democratic intentions. The next government, formed under Jafar Sharif Emami, 1910 to 1998, another of the Shah's cronies, further aggravated general malcontent. Born to a family with old clerical ties, he was trained as an engineer in Germany in the interwar period. His appointment was largely the result of the Shah's concern over the restive clergy. Most likely, he viewed Sharif Emami's appointment as a conciliatory gesture toward the clerical moderates, especially in the face of Khomeini's gradual rise to prominence. The new premier's brief term, ending in May 1961, more than a month after Barujerdi's death on March 30th, was riddled by corruption scandals. With the American presidential election campaign underway and viable prospects for a democratic victory, there was growing concern in Tehran about what the implications of John F. Kennedy's presidency would be for the Pahlavi regime. Kennedy was openly critical of the Republicans' foreign policy in the developing world, and he questioned outright military aid to oppressive regimes that ignored economic development and democracy. He considered economic and political reforms as alternative means of saving non-Western societies from the lure of socialist-inspired revolutions. The collapse in Cuba of the U.S.-backed dictator Fulgencio Batista in early 1959 and Fidel Castro's rapid shift from a nationalist revolutionary to a committed Marxist made his points all the more glaring. At the time, perhaps no other country besides Iran fit Kennedy's disapproval of the U.S. granting of unconditional military largesse and moral support. It was therefore quite plausible that beyond Latin America, Iran would become a priority for the new administration. Changes in the American attitude aside, by 1960 the Iranian economy was in crisis. Poor monetary management, aggravated by meager economic performance and imperial grandeur, stirred popular resentment. A handful of elite figures, veterans of the National Front, and clerical critics of the Shah, were buoyed by the prospects of a shift in U.S. policy toward Iran. The appointment of Ali Amini, 1905 to 1992, as Prime Minister was seen as a fresh start, as he aimed to implement long-awaited reforms to Iran's agrarian economy and, as Amini used to say, tighten the belts. Disliked by the Shah because of his American connections and the fact that he was personally acquainted with Kennedy, Amini was expected to liberate Iranian politics from the yoke of autocracy and represent a wider political spectrum. During his 14-month term of office, May 1961 to July 1962, Amini barely managed to deliver what was expected of him, given the enormity of the problems he had to grapple with and his own managerial limitations. Born into a Qajar aristocratic lineage, he was a grandson of the reforming statesman Ali Khan Amin al-Dowleh. Having received two French doctorates in law and economics, Amini's political career displayed encouraging signs of independence and pragmatism, but also compromise and resignation. He had been a protege of Davar in the Reza Shah years, and later an associate of Ahmad Gavam. But he also served under Mossadegh as Minister of Education and after the coup under Zahedi, he was instrumental in concluding the 1954 oil concession with the IOP consortium. In the late 1950s, as Iranian ambassador to Washington, his credentials as a middle-of-the-road statesman appealed to the Americans. For a brief period at the outset of his premiership, he also enjoyed some popularity among the Iranian public as a clean and progressive statesman. The Amini government was a mix of the old elite and new faces, even radical veterans from the Mossadegh era. The most visible and most effective was Hassan Arsanjani, 1922-1969, Minister of Agriculture and the architect of the land reform campaign. A fiery journalist and lawyer who once had belonged to the radical wing of Gavam's Democrat Party, Arsanjani long entertained land reform as the key to dismantling the landowning elite, including Amini's own family. His rapid land distribution program aimed not only to parcel out the state-owned arable land, Khaleseh, to peasants already working on it, but also to redistribute private estates controlled by a small but powerful class of landowners, Malakin. Land reform and the changing village. Even by the 1960s, agriculture was the largest sector of the Iranian economy outside of government-controlled revenue from the oil industry, and it employed the largest number of people as tillers of the land, providing subsidiary and secondary jobs as well, and sustaining the landowners. Made up mostly of absentee landlords residing in the cities, the large landowning sector consisted of bureaucratic nobility and their offspring, tribal khans and their urbanized offspring, provincial elite, and bazaar merchants, who altogether owned more than 70% of the country's arable land. The remaining 30% was held by small landowners, independent farmers, mostly in the northern provinces, and religious endowments. Operating on an ancient agrarian sharecropping arrangement known as bonnet, the five-part means of production – land, water, seed, ox, and labour – determined the respective portions of income for landlord, arbab, and peasant, raiyat, with some local variances. While the landlords controlled the first three, and occasionally the fourth as well, and reaped shares accordingly, the peasants could provide only labour and the ox, while often paying a larger portion of taxes to the state at harvest time. The system was marked by extra burden for the peasant, who had to deal with bailiffs, government agents, and gendarmerie, as well as conditions that at best offered a life only at the subsistence level, and at worst sheer destitution for as much as half of the country's population. Scattered across the vast span of the Iranian plateau and the slopes and ravines that punctuated it, Iranian villages typically consisted of adobe-like mud structures that, though scenic from afar, close up, displayed the extent of rural deprivation. The houses, more often clusters of primitive huts, made of unbaked mud bricks with few windows, little ventilation, and unstable wooden roof beams, contrasted with the better-built and better-maintained landlord's mansion. For villagers, there was no running water, even though there was frequently access to a clean communal source such as a spring well or a ganat, and no modern amenities, including electricity, or access to modern medical facilities or modern schools. Ironically, the end of the Qajar land tenure system and sanctioning of the right to private land ownership in the Iranian constitution and in the subsequent register of land titles had only reasserted control of the private landowning sector over the haphazard agrarian system. Organized around sedentary or semi-nomadic economies, the village tied the subsistence agrarian economy to animal husbandry. Although the landlord, or the bailiff on the landlord's behalf, oversaw the operation of the village with a certain autonomy and along a patriarchal model, the system did allow peasants some freedoms of mobility, such as negotiating the terms of the sharecropping contract, and encouraged some level of village communal solidarity. Yet the village economy was barely able to withstand drastic changes, such as those introduced by the land reforms of the 1960s. The substitution of the landlord by a government-run agency, first the Ministry of Agriculture, and then the Ministry of Land Reform, added layers of bureaucratic complexity to the system, and with unexpected outcomes. The small parcels of land distributed to each peasant often were not economically viable. The liberated farmers, as the state-run media dubbed them, did not have access to sufficient capital and lacked experience in running modern farming machinery, and had to rely on traditional methods. Despite widespread state publicity to the contrary, soon inefficiency, a relative decline in agricultural production, and the glaring failure of agricultural cooperatives set up to address these problems became apparent. Haphazard mechanization, and soon migration to the cities, further hindered a successful transition to the new system. Already in the 1950s, some of the estates and smaller plots expropriated by Reza Shah, mostly in the Caspian provinces, had been returned to their original owners or redistributed to small landowners. First through litigation in the courts, which after the fall of Reza Shah handed down judgments in favour of the original owners, and then voluntarily by the Shah, most if not all confiscated lands were returned. The Pahlavi Foundation, both a charity and a holding company for the Pahlavi family, was in charge of early land distribution. Yet much remained in dispute with the Pahlavi family members and with some of the army officers from the Reza Shah era who had forcefully expropriated lands and refused to return them. The Land Reform Law of 1960, amended in 1962, allowed the Amini government in 1961 to start the first stage of distribution of the large estates, some consisting of tens of villages belonging to a single owner or an extended family. First in Azerbaijan province, and soon after in other provinces, a new survey of the large estates was followed by the parcelling out of small plots to resident tenants, and later, some seasonal workers. The compensation made to landowners, and the methods of recovering over the long term the price of the land from villagers, though generally judicious, proved hard to implement. The law allowed landlords to retain the title for one village under their own name, but a notorious loophole made it possible for the landlord's immediate family members to secure villages under their names as well. By 1966, the end of the first phase of the land reforms, 4 years after the fall of Amini's government, nearly 14,000 villages, some 30% of the estimated total number of Iranian villages, were wholly or partially distributed to more than 500,000 families, a population that roughly corresponded to about 30% of Iran's rural population. Often, the plots of land allocated to farmers were not sufficient for a profitable operation, even by pre-industrial standards, in a country with limited water resources, routine fallowing practices, and low crop return. The second and third phases of land reform implemented between 1965 and 1969 were more conservative, for they allowed landlords to retain much larger arable plots. The state apparatus, moreover, often failed to provide sufficient credit and machinery for the newly created agricultural cooperatives that were to replace the landlord's function. By the end of 1968, more than 8,500 rural cooperatives were in place throughout Iran, although far fewer than that were economically competitive. Poor living and working conditions in villages also contributed to the slow progress of land reforms. Even by 1966, fewer than 4% of rural households had electricity, and less than 1% benefited from piped water. By 1966, still some 85% of the rural population was illiterate. In terms of income, the rural population, which accounted for more than 60% of the total population, earned only 30% of the national income. The culture of maintaining agricultural machinery was weak, and modern agricultural methods, fertilization and disease prevention, were inadequate or unsuitable to the local climate. Encountering throughout the 1960s disparities between investment returns in the agricultural sector versus the urban sector, and a parochial village culture resistant to mechanization, the government first resorted to handing out small agricultural loans and sending assistance in the form of technicians and literacy corps, Sepahe Danesh workers. Later on, similar to the Soviet kolkhozy, the regional agricultural cooperatives were established, relying, somewhat unrealistically, on farmers' collaborative capabilities. Soon it became apparent that the cooperatives could not replace the villages in their role as the time-honoured units of production. Despite the regime's optimistic wish to create a rural utopia, villages stubbornly preserved some of their traditional customs and production methods, even though, as the backbone of the agrarian economy, they were visibly weakened. An emerging class of landowners, among them landlords and moneyed intermediaries, began to purchase smaller plots from villagers and turn them into enterprises, often independent of the traditional village economy. By the 1970s, villages were rapidly becoming a liability for the state, rather than functioning as productive agricultural units, as they had been for centuries. Thousands of small, self-sustaining, often isolated villages and hamlets, with populations as large as a few thousand or as small as a few families, started a slow decline. The villagers soon turned into consumers of subsidized commodities, even foodstuffs provided by government agencies, while sending off their young labour force to the cities to earn the much-needed subsidy income for the family. Villages near cities were all but absorbed into urban sprawl, and larger ones, far from urban centres, proudly declared themselves towns and cities, though with diminishing agricultural production. By the mid-1970s, Iran, with its rising population and changing demography, became for the first time a net importer of grain, and then later of other foodstuffs as well. It is difficult not to feel nostalgic about a rural economy that had persisted for millennia across the Iranian plateau. Some villages retained names from Sasanian and pre-Sasanian times, and many were scattered across remote corners of the country, at high elevations, on the mountain slopes, on riverfronts, deep inside forests, and on the edges or in the midst of the central and eastern deserts. These were the only viable oases for a human presence, often with limited but renewable water resources furnished by the long trails of Ganat canals stretching from the mountain slopes to fertile plains, irrigating small and hard-worked fields along with smaller fruit and vegetable gardens. The houses in the village were close together, leading to a village commons where the Ganat water poured into a common cistern. There were a few stores, and the walled garden of the landlord's manor house was nearby. The tightly knit village community predominantly practiced endogamy, preserved a clear kin lineage, and a patriarchal seniority represented by the village headman. Among a host of lasting issues dividing neighboring villages from one another were disputes over water rights, putting the so-called upstreamers against the downstreamers. Villagers often distrusted urbanites, especially the bailiffs and government gendarmes. Most lived in relative poverty, though compared to Egyptian fellahin and Indian kisanes, they enjoyed a better standard of living. Although it is difficult to generalize, one can compare Iranian peasants' quality of life as favorable to that of most other peasants in regions of the Middle East, perhaps with the exception of the Levant and the Aegean coast. The land reform slowly transformed that communal life, and with it the village. Modern brick houses with better lighting and sanitation, but often clumsily built and climatically unsuitable, appeared on the landscape. With new roads came pickup trucks, deep well technology, and power generators. Donkeys, mules, and camels gradually lost their function as beasts of burden and diminished greatly in numbers. Western clothing replaced customary village dress and headgear. Radios, and later television, tainted regional accents. And modern household goods and appliances changed living and even eating habits, as well as modes of leisure. The inevitable process of change had the unintended consequence of liberating the majority of the population from the land, and, in due course, profoundly changing Iran's socio-economic and cultural composition. The 1969 film Gav, The Cow, by the gifted director Dariush Mehrouji, born 1939, and based on a short story by Gholam Hossein Saedi, 1936-1985, inspired probably by a children's rhyme, offers a piercing metaphor for the metamorphosis of Iranian villages. Mashdi Hassan's pregnant cow, the only one in the village, dies of mysterious causes. The villagers, aware of the owner's attachment to his animal, try to cover it up. Once Mashdi Hassan learns of the death, he falls into a deep depression and begins to see himself as his beloved cow, a mental condition that leads to his total estrangement. Though one may detect a certain romanticizing of idyllic rural life, the film carried a poignant message of the impact of modernity on rural routines. With the cow as the symbol of life, and as the only asset of the peasant, besides his labor, in the agrarian system that came with the land reform. It is as if the cow's death alludes not only to the loss of the peasant's means of production, but also to a melancholy demise of the traditional village life, and in a broader context, the cultural alienation of the country as a whole. Amini's troubled tenure. Aside from the land reform, which was soon to face stiff resistance from tribal Khans and some ranking clergy, the focus of Amini's government was mostly fiscal. He had served in the Ministry of Finance, and utilized austerity measures, an anti-corruption campaign, and a large loan negotiated with the United States to pay off the budget deficit. The dissolution of the 20th Majlis was meant to assist Amini in carrying out his reform program. The mandate to uproot corruption brought Amini momentary popularity, which he proved unable to convert into a solid base of support. An avid centrist, he quickly became a spoof for the satirical press. The weekly Tawfiq, which relished taking cheap shots at Amini and his cabinet, took advantage of the opening political climate to mock the premier for being hopelessly ineffectual. Dailies were no less cynical about Amini and his promised reforms. The global recession of the early 1960s, moreover, hit the Iranian economy hard. The country's increasing dependence on Western markets because of oil exports and foreign imports had become painfully apparent. The psychological impact of the recession reached a crisis level once Amini declared the government virtually bankrupt, which he attributed to mismanagement and fraud. The credit market collapsed, and imports and exports came to a standstill, causing a chain reaction of bankruptcies in the bazaar at a time when the land reform program had begun to deprive many big merchants of supplementary revenue. Amini's hesitancy to hold yet another election to convene the Majlis brought him head-to-head with the revived Second National Front. They were mostly statesmen of the Mossadegh era, including Alahyar Saleh, Karim Sanjabi, Gholam Hossein Sadighi, and Shapur Bakhtiar, with recognition among university students, civil servants, the secular middle classes, and some bazaar businesses, though they also enjoyed some grassroots support. As was the case with the First National Front, their style of leadership favoured rule of law, free and fair elections, and public deliberation. These were at variance with Amini's calls for quick economic measures and rule by decree. Amini evidently feared that another round of elections might return to the Majlis reactionary landlords and their agents, who no doubt would block land reforms and other programs. Relying on popular support, the National Front rejected Amini's argument, having been convinced that the Premier, in collusion with the Shah, was determined to bar members of the opposition from entering the Majlis. Despite an impressive show of immediate support in street demonstrations and university protests, the Second National Front generally did not make any political headway. The Shah, the army, and the conservative clergy, not to mention Amini, were suspicious, especially of the younger generation of left-leaning activists under the umbrella of the National Front. Tehran University, a centre of National Front activism, which included the remaining two Deh loyalists, witnessed a series of demonstrations against the regime. They met with riot police, intimidation, and detention by the Savak, which predictably further radicalized the already tense climate of confrontation. Loyal to the Constitution's principles, the leaders of the National Front neither could fully embrace the aspirations of the younger generations of activists, nor were they able or willing to collaborate with the Amini government. That Mossadegh, from his exile in Ahmadabad, increasingly rendered his blessings to the younger and more radical elements on the fringes of the National Front, further disheartened the leadership. Hoping for a breakthrough, they waited for a ripe moment, which never came. They were instead harassed, arrested, and eventually banned from political activity by the Shah. Amini, trying to keep the Americans on his side, lost a crucial chance to check the Shah's unwieldy ambitions. Isolated after only 14 months in office, Amini's government showed signs of weariness when it faced its final challenge over the allocation of the budget. Hoping to cut the military budget as an austerity measure, Amini met the Shah's stiff resistance. The Shah was well aware of the Americans' strategic desire to build up Iranian armed forces, as he was mindful of his own support within the military. that the United States denied a $250 million loan promised to the Amini government made it clear where the superpower's priorities lay, hence precipitating the government's downfall. Amini resigned and left the country, leaving the stage clear for the Shah, who, during his visit to the United States in April, had prepared the ground for the forthcoming change. By June 24, 1962, Julius Holmes, the American ambassador to Tehran, considered Amini a spent force. The White Revolution. The Shah's return to center stage, to the displeasure of the opposition, began a new era of a more determined imperial rule that lasted until the end of the Shah's reign. In this new guise, he was to be the savior of exploited peasants and workers, an almost revolutionary pose that aimed to replace his earlier image as a malleable pawn of the Western powers. The new initiative, the White Revolution, primarily hinged on a government-enforced reform program that incorporated the land redistribution, but soon continued to add other features. It was meant to convey a sense of peaceful and bloodless, but drastic, change. In this scheme of things, the losers were supposed to be the landowning elite and their associates, and the chief winner, the Shah and the people. Hence the Revolution of the Shah and the People, Engelab-e Shah va Mardum, underscored a new mandate that bypassed the old structure of power, in effect eliminating the intermediaries who stood between ruler and ruled. The Shah's visit to the United States in April 1962, at the invitation of President Kennedy, offered the moral support for the Shah to take over the reform agenda of the Amini government and expand on it. By August 1962, President Kennedy's letter, though guarded in tone, gave the Shah the necessary assurances that Iran will receive the military hardware and economic assistance the Shah had insisted upon for some time. The United States greatly appreciates the highly important strategic location of Iran and your steadfastness in remaining vigilant against the pressures of international communism. In deciding what we both can do to strengthen Iran's national security, however, it is also necessary that your urgent social and economic programs and the resources available to carry them out be taken into account. To implement the reforms, in July 1962, the Shah had already appointed, in place of Amini, his longtime confidant Asadullah Alam, 1919-1978, a shrewd enabler and a scion of a landowning family from central Khorasan. Alam was once the leader of the all-too-loyal opposition Mardum Party. He proved himself a trusted agent who was ready to implement the Shah's royal wishes. Retaining Afsanjani for a few more years as agriculture minister, the Shah accelerated the land reforms despite serious opposition, which had begun to build even before Amini's dismissal. In February 1963, a stage-managed referendum on the 6 points of the White Revolution brought out 6 million voters, for the first time including women. With no meaningful debate put forward, and with heavy propaganda in the state media, the approval rate was a predictable 91.6%. The referendum, though devoid of any constitutional legitimacy, furnished the much-needed nominal mandate for the Shah's 6-point revolution. The much-abused term Engelab clearly was appropriated from the left, and the white attribute had a double meaning, implying a mass movement distinct from the red traitors and the black reactionaries, Erteja-e Siyah, labels the Shah appended to the Tudeh opposition and vociferous clerical critics, respectively. As early as 1959, it is noteworthy, the Shah's government had threatened Ayatollah Barujerdi with implementing a white coup if the latter failed to comply with the legislation on land reform before the Majlis. Although the measure did not win immediate approval among the deputies, it soon offered the Shah a chance to reiterate his demand in the form of the White Revolution. Aside from land reform, the most effective article in what came to be known as the 6 points of the revolution was the Literacy Corps, inspired as much by Kennedy's Peace Corps as by the Soviet, North Vietnamese, and Chinese regimented literacy campaigns. The program drafted thousands of urban high school male and later female graduates to be sent off, as part of their 2-year military service, to villages throughout the country. They were given rudimentary training on how to run a rural elementary school and carry out a literacy program for both children and adults. Often being the sole teacher and administrator in their remote posts, these corps members enjoyed a privileged status in the village community. Aside from their teaching function, draftees into the literacy corps represented the secularizing culture of the cities. They stood apart from the landlords and their bailiffs, now mostly gone, headmen, village elders, village malars, and the rural gendarme. Their teaching method, educational material, and school space, too, stood apart from the humble village maktabs, run by female tutors. The outcome, at least in the earlier years, was impressive by the standards of the time. Hundreds of thousands of young villagers, boys and girls, were educated in often mixed single-room schools with bare facilities, and some went on to continue their secondary education in district schools or nearby towns. Within 5 years of the start of the program in 1963, more than 500,000 boys and about 130,000 girls were enrolled in literacy corps schools. By 1970, 3,000 such schools had been built throughout Iran. By 1977, enrollment in these schools had grown nearly sevenfold in 15 years. Yet the education they received often served as an additional incentive for rural migration. A degree of social alienation was prevalent among the young literacy corps teachers. Few observers believed in the effectiveness of the campaign, despite its remarkable efforts to reach remote villages, far from provincial towns and accessible only by mule over nearly impassable mountain tracks. Some recruits remained cynical of their wasted time in the isolation of remote villages and acted condescendingly, if not hostilely, toward villagers. Others were struck by the abject poverty and deprivation, and the experience soon converted some to radical causes. Despite many drawbacks, the Literacy Corps, perhaps more than its subsequently introduced campaigns, the Health Corps and Development Corps, was effective in breaking through the barriers between city and village. Some modern amenities followed the trail of the Literacy Corps: rural health clinics with local paramedics, dirt roads with motorbike or van service, electricity generators, fertilizers, vaccination, agricultural machinery, household goods, and telephone communication. Yet opening to the outside also brought vices and tensions, ranging from opium addiction among young recruits, illegally but inexpensively available in many villages, to involvement of inexperienced corps members in local feuds, inappropriate advances toward young village girls, and embarrassing sexual escapades, and violation of local ethnic and religious traditions. One achievement of lasting consequence was the steady rise of literacy throughout the 1960s and 1970s, which reached nearly 75% by the end of the Pahlavi era, at least on paper. This success was offset by the uncritical nature of state-sponsored education in the cities as well as in the countryside. The lopsided school curriculum favoured an approach to education that glorified the state and demanded conformity and compliance. The widening gap in the 1970s between the deafening state propaganda on the success of the White Revolution and the grim realities of everyday life was glaring. For the vast majority of educated and semi-educated youth with growing demands, education thus contributed to their fascination with the alternative ideologies that would soon shake the Pahlavi regime to its core.